Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Mara and WNYC. By the way, last week when Andrea Bernstein was filling in, she had a conversation with you about how New York is becoming a mecca for top-notch coffee, with lots of gourmet coffee shops looking to replace your watery bodega brew. Well, we got so many listener suggestions for the best coffee in the city that we've put together a brand new feature on our website. It's the Brian Lehrer Show Cup of Joe Favorite Coffee Shops Map. You can see the map on our blog. There's a link at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And if you didn't get your suggestion in time, you can still add it in the comments section, and then we'll add it to the map. So check out the BL Show Cup of Joe map at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we've heard a great deal in the past few years about a crisis among teenage boys. Young men are falling behind their female counterparts in college admission and graduation. They're using drugs at higher rates, developing eating disorders, suffering from low self-esteem, and unable to deal with their emotions much more than girls, according to research. But our next guest says, not so fast. A lot of these kids are thoughtful and resilient. And so with me now is Melina Saval, author of the book, The Secret Lives of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens. Melina, thanks so much for coming on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So boys are more likely to drop out or be suspended from school, more likely to receive a diagnosis of ADHD, more likely to be involved with drugs and crime and alcohol. So there's not a crisis among boys?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that it's all relative. I mean, you know, you can look at those statistics, but there's a lot of things that you have to consider. First of all, it takes time to crunch those numbers, and a lot of times those statistics don't reflect the reality in the current, you know, of the now. So that's one factor. Also, you have to look at the fact that a lot of these statistics are changing over the years, and, you know, rates of crime are going down for boys, rates of drug use are going down, more boys are graduating from high school than before. But really, I mean, the focus of this book wasn't on the statistics. The focus of the book was on the things that the stats don't necessarily show you. I wanted to go beyond, you know, the bar graphs and the pie charts, mm-hmm. and really give the boys a chance to use their own voices, because with a lot of different statistics, they're very black and white, and there's a lot of nuanced information about boys that doesn't come through on numbers. So while those statistics certainly do right to spur alarm in certain instances, overall, you know, these boys are not being given a chance in our society to talk and let us know what they're feeling and what's going on, and even the reasoning behind some of those statistics. And, you know, statistics are numbers, and they don't get at the whole story, and they don't reflect exactly what's going on in every detail. So I really wanted to go beyond those statistics and find out what is going on with these boys. And the boys that I spoke to, you know, gave a lot of reason that we should actually be encouraged and really hopeful about where boys go and who boys are and what they're doing. That is great.
And you profile, you know, 10 boys in the book with 10 different demographic backgrounds. You even give them kind of informal labels: an indie music obsessed kid, an overachiever, a wealthy private school boy, a teenage father. Were there any baseline similarities against all these demographically different boys that you would want to start with in describing what you heard?
Yeah, I mean, I want to point out that I did not give the boys those labels. They gave themselves those labels.
Uh-huh.
Actually, you know, a really important point is that the boys finally got a chance to define themselves. A lot of times these labels were self-referential, based on a clique or a clan that they belonged to in school. A lot of times they were ironic. A lot of times they reflected the way they thought society viewed them. So I just want to put it out there that this was their opportunity to name themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Across the board, I would say that I explored a lot of common themes: resilience, loneliness, a lot of strength, a lot of optimism, a feeling of not belonging, a feeling of, quote unquote, there are no other kids like me out there. And what was interesting, it didn't matter from what socioeconomic background they came, what race, what nationality, they all felt that they were different and that they didn't have anything in common. But what I really found is that, you know, in this collective sense of really not fitting in, they actually had a tremendous amount of things in common.
That's classic teenage alienation, right? The feeling of not fitting in with anybody?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you know, we've all, who's been a teenager and hasn't felt that they didn't fit in at one point or another? I think if you always feel that you fit in, you know, you're lying, and that's not even that interesting anyway.
I thought the internet solved that, because teenagers can always find somebody like them online now.
Well, it's interesting that you pointed that out, because there are so many other, you know, we're living in such a media maelstrom, and there's so many outlets, and it's become a veritable emotional free-for-all out there. I mean, you can blog about, you know, feeling suicidal. You can, you know, blog about your parents dying. You can blog about having a venereal disease. You can blog about feeling happy or sad.
Not just blog about, but you can find a community that's discussing it.
Of course, but what's interesting is there's so many anonymous outlets, you know, essentially, because you're only knowing each other's screen names. And it doesn't complete these boys. It doesn't give them a sense that they belong. I mean, there's more opportunity than ever to emote and to find people that share, you know, like interest or whatnot. But the irony is that even in all that, the boys still have this sense that they don't really fit in anywhere, mostly because it's not tangible. I mean, having someone to talk to over the internet isn't the same as having someone to talk to in person, and that's what these boys really felt that they were lacking. They had people talking to them in the way of parents or maybe teachers, but they didn't have anyone to talk with, and it's a really important distinction and something that they talked about quite often when I talked with them and interviewed them.
Melina Saval, my guest on WNYC, author of The Secret Lives of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens. And male teens, our lives are open for you. Our lines are open for you and our lives. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Parents can call as well. Teachers can call. If you're not a teenage boy, maybe you used to be a teenage boy and you have something to say. What should we understand about teenage boys today? And what should that change? Is there something we should be doing in terms of public policy, family behavior, anything else to assist boys? Call and let us know. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We don't have a lot of teenagers who listen to the show, but if you happen to be one of them, and for today, especially if you're male, what do you think the world needs to know about you or about teenage boys as a group? 212-433-WNYC. Had an 18-year-old caller yesterday, a guy. 212-433-9692 for Melina Saval, author of The Secret Lives of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens. Melina, why'd you use the word raw in the title?
Well, because it's uncensored. It's in their words. I mean, you know, for the most part, these are the voices of the boys, you know, unexpurgated. I didn't really do a lot to change what they had to say in a lot of situations, even if what they said was incendiary or maybe slightly shocking or rude. I mean, I just wanted to give the boys a chance to just say whatever came to their mind. So just keep it raw, keep it real.
Yeah. You know, when people talk about the boy crisis, some feminists get upset, saying no one called it a crisis when girls were less likely to go to college. Is your book part of that debate? The backlash to the backlash to reviving Ophelia, that book about lost teenage girls in the 90s?
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, an important point I want to make is that I didn't set out to do a comparative study of girl versus boy. That was never my intention. There's actually a lot of wonderful books about teenage girls today. I would say the one thing that I did take notice of was that there's a veritable glut of girl power manifestos and books about teenage girls, everything from Reviving Ophelia to Queen Bees and Wannabes, and a lot of them are quite good, and they present girls, even if they present them in crisis, so to speak, they present them as multidimensional characters, but the very few offerings about boys really presented them as these like amorphous globules, you know, like they're all the same. They're all, you know, limp spaghettis or paralyzed creatures. They can't emote. So while I didn't do a girl-boy study, I mean, you have to take notice that there are so many books about girls, and the books about boys, the ones that exist for the most part, I found, were very clinical, and I wanted to not do a book like that. I wanted to take boys and hang out with them as they go to rock concerts and as they're studying for tests, and I wanted to take them out of that clinical setting. So it wasn't girl versus boy. But
So what about the issue of gender role changes over the last generation? Really, a lot of these, you know, that mostly came in before their lifetimes, but that they're growing up with as part of the context. What kinds of stories did you hear about that?
You mean like the boys versus how their parents, how their fathers were raised, and just the differences in terms of what's expected of men?
Yes, what's expected of them in terms of gender roles? Do they understand their, you know, what it means to be male today? Is it something that they're getting mixed messages on, having to figure out for themselves, any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think, okay, let's just take crying, for example. A lot of these boys grew up with fathers for whom it was not okay to cry. And I met a lot of boys who cried in front of me. And I think for them, they were trying to kind of overturn that notion that men can't be emotional. I think in a way it was not a rebellion, but something they wanted to show that didn't have to be the case with them. I mean, little things like boys are wearing pink. I found for the most part it wasn't a generational thing, but it was actually a cultural thing, because I met boys for whom, you know, their fathers were raised in a certain way, and in that community to show emotion was absolutely a no-no. And then I met other boys for whom it was okay for their fathers. So I wouldn't say across the board it was just a general, you know, generational thing, but that said, you know, definitely a lot of them, it's, you know, had heard stories from their dads about how they weren't supposed to do this and they weren't supposed to do that. And for these boys, you know, they felt that it was perfectly okay. I mean, again, I met boys who were, all the boys that I met were emotional, without exception. All of them talked a lot. They had so much to say. So actually for them, the notion that boys couldn't be this way, while maybe they heard stories from their fathers, it wasn't something that they really held on to as something that they had to be like as well. They really were striking out and being their own people. And whether that has to do with media, you know, one thing that strikes out is, let's say, fashion, for example. Men are not supposed to be interested in fashion, let's just say. That's an old construct. Right. I mean, I didn't meet boys that were, like, necessarily all the time, like, gabbing about fashion or looking through Vogue, but I met a lot of boys who would look at, you know, a fashion pictorial and say details and say, ooh, I want to have that shirt, I like that jacket. And they weren't gay. You know, I think that's another notion, that, like, to be interested in these feminine, quote-unquote feminine things, you were, you know, there was, you were, you know, your sexuality was questioned.
Metrosexual.
Metrosexual, but even that, I mean, you know, they were just boys who wanted to, you know, wear cool clothes.
Look good. Yeah.
It helped identify not only their style, but, you know, their character and who they were. I mean, if they wore a black shirt, it was, you know, one day, and eyeliner, that was obviously, they were feeling different that day than they were in the day that they wore, you know, a checkered polo shirt. So it was an expression of their personality, just as it is for women. I mean, these boys are people, right? And people like to express themselves through clothes. And so, you know, the metrosexual thing isn't something that necessarily even came up a lot with these teens.
Right. Melina Saval, author of The Secret Lives of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens, and Jonathan in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay. What'd you call to say?
I guess that, you know, I find that, you know, there's a lot of stressing in this conversation about the role of, you know, authority figures and counselors, and, you know, outlets like that to open up emotionally, and really the, you know, the desire for boys to be able to, I guess, express their emotions. And I think what's really being minimized here is the need for boys to have, you know, peers of their own. You know, it's nice if you can sit down, and, you know, myself being 22 and coming from a bit of an angry adolescence, you know, it's nice if you can sit down with, you know, with somebody who's paid by your parents or paid by the district to, you know, to speak with you and to provide you a forum for airing your grievances against society. But it doesn't give you, you know, that's not what gives you respect for yourself. What gives you respect for yourself is really having, you know, a group of peers that respect you for who you are.
Melina?
Right, absolutely. No, absolutely. And I mean, throughout my book, actually, one of the main points that I make is in various different chapters, these boys who were not able to talk to their parents had friends that really helped get them through different crises that they were experiencing, different things that were going on in their life. There's a chapter called The Rich Kid in which I talk about a boy who's battling obsessive compulsive disorder. For so long, he could not come forth with this secret to his parents. And so he had a best friend that really became his salvation. There's another chapter where a boy, he's a teenage dad, and he talks about how his half-brother was really just key in him getting through some horrible times in his life, some tragedies. So throughout the book, I make the point that, you know, parents don't have to necessarily be all things to their kids, and in fact, they shouldn't, and they don't have to be the best friend. And these teens, you know, people in general need people their own age, peers, you know, or not even just your, you know, not necessarily your own age, but in the same ballpark, or just, you know, that they can talk to. And throughout the book, these boys really have shared with me their remarkable stories of friendship. I think friendship is actually one of the most, loyalty is one of the most undersold qualities about boys. The friendships between these boys was beautiful and poignant, and really just there was a lot of love and trust between these boys and their friends. And even the boys said, if we're talking girl versus boy, I did notice that the boys would comment a lot about how they noticed that friendships between girls could often be a little duplicitous, and they would see girls being really nice to one another in front of their face, but then turn their back and, you know, say some nasty things about them. And they said, you know what, for me and my friends, it's not like that. We're close and we're honest with each other, and if we have a problem, we actually say it to the person's face.
Interesting.
So they talked a lot about friendships and how much they meant and how much they really relied on them. So, no, absolutely. I mean, that's incredibly important.
And Jonathan, thank you so much. Chris in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on how, like, on most TV and commercials and sitcoms, how most of the men are usually portrayed, and, you know, their character is usually like a dimwit. And I think since that's, like, really the majority of men on TV, that I think most men probably feel comfortable playing that role. So it's like that character is kind of, like, typical. So they find, like, that's probably what a man is, or they feel comfortable not even trying to change that.
Melina?
I don't know if I'd necessarily agree, because I watch a lot of the TV that I do watch actually presents men as interesting kind of multi-layered characters. I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of comedies out there where men act like dimwits, but lest we forget, a lot of the women on those shows act like dimwits too. I mean, that's kind of the nature of the comedy formula a lot of the times. I can say that for these boys that I spoke to, and I didn't just speak to 10. I mean, I whittled it down to 10 major profiles, but I talked to dozens and dozens of boys. And I would say very few of them actually felt that the way they were projected in the media really affected how they acted.
Family Guy, The Simpsons, things like that.
Right, but they didn't.
Like King,
but,
I mean,
they
I
didn't
mean,
look, just, at, they didn't look at those.
Chris, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Like, I was just saying, like, just kind of like, I mean, how, I don't know, I guess, the, you know, with the gender thing, it's kind of like, you know, like the saying of who wears the pants in the house, it's just that it's kind of like being flipped around, like the woman are usually seen in charge, and like music, like whenever you hear like songs, it's the woman who's saying I'm independent, and it's the man who's saying baby I need you, in like most of them. So,
yeah, that's interesting. I mean, these boys weren't yet in a position where they were in a household where they were married, so I think you're coming from a different perspective.
Yeah.
And also, you know, you mentioned The Simpsons and Family Guy, and it's funny because when the caller said dimwits, I didn't even think of those shows, because those shows are brilliant in their comedy and, you know, a little off topic, but these boys, yeah, they were fans of The Simpsons, but they didn't feel like they had to be Bart Simpson.
Right.
They could appreciate it and not say, oh, I have to be that way. So the fact that people assume that media sways these kids or these boys all the time, I actually take issue with that, because of course it permeates our culture and it has an effect, absolutely. But I didn't meet boys who said, oh, I watched the show, this guy's a dimwit, therefore I'm going to be one. These boys were strong and they were interesting, and I think even the notion that we can be so, you know, like boys can watch a TV show and be so influenced to the point where it completely rearranges their personality, I have a problem with that, and I didn't find that to be true with the boys that I spoke to at all.
And Chris, thank you for your call. How about single moms, absentee fathers, families that either are broken or never formed, without a male very present for these boys. It's so prevalent in our country right now. Did you get into that?
Yeah, I mean, there are several chapters in which the boys are not living with their biological father, for example, and it obviously had an effect on them. It affected how they view the world. I mean, sometimes it made them, it had different effects on all of them. I mean, you're speaking about a lot of issues, and there are different ways in which you cannot be living with your biological father. There can be divorce, or there can be abandonment. And I actually spoke to a wonderful psychotherapist named Ethan Pollack, from Massachusetts, and we spoke a lot about children of divorce, and he didn't like the term broken family, which is something that's used a lot and which mm-hmm. he disused. And I agree, and a lot of the boys that I spoke to whose parents were divorced, they were children whose parents were divorced, and, you know, it was, for them, it could be tough, and sometimes it could not be tough, and, you know, a lot of them said, and in fact, the first chapter, the indie, and then a word following it that we can't say on the air, but this particular kid who was into indie music, he actually said that he would hate to feel that his parents' divorce defined him in any large way, meaning, yes, his parents are divorced, but that's not the sum total of who he is. There was so much more to him than just being a kid of divorce. And so, again, there are statistics that say, you know, kids of divorce are more likely to do this, or kids without dads are more likely to do this. And, yes, they're true statistically. But I just wanted to be known that for a lot of these kids, they were still high-functioning, brilliant kids who weren't doomed to the same fate as their parents. And I think that's a dangerous notion.
We just have 30 seconds left, but here's a post on our webpage from someone writing as a New Jersey boy. And he says, as a boy just leaving high school, I believe that much of the disparity in male-female school results comes from a school environment that is more fitting for girls and boys. Sit down, be quiet, read this deep, meaningful book, think deeply. Neuroanalysis studies have proven that boys' brains are more active, et cetera, et cetera. And we have 20 seconds left for a last thought, Melina.
Well, you know, I think there's so much that this person just said. I think that boys, yes, they do have active imaginations, and they're tactile, and they have a lot to absorb, and they have a lot to give out, and they're definitely emotional. And you know, the main premise of my book is that there's so much more to boys than just, you know, them being a crisis alerting headline.
Right.
And I think I wanted to go beyond that, and I think other people should too.
And you did, and that's where we have to leave it. Thank you for this conversation and for the book.
Thank you so much.
The Secret Life of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens by Melina Sabal. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.